This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Good evening. Welcome to our second shiur here on Sefer Tehillim. Tonight we're going to be talking about how do the Psalms read biblical narratives, right? How do the Mizmorei Tehillim refer to and interpret earlier biblical stories? How do they weave them into their compositions, and to what end do they do so, right? Why do sometimes some of the Mizmorei Tehillim refer back to earlier stories? Where do they do this, and what can we learn from it, right? So that's pretty much what our topic is tonight. In our previous class, we talked a little bit about David's life, and we talked about how David's life shows up often in the Mizmorei Tehillim, especially in the titles, but also sometimes in the Mizmorei Tehillim themselves. Tonight we're not going to be talking about the titles at all. We're going to be talking about other biblical stories, not particularly David's story, that show up inside the Mizmorei Tehillim themselves. And I'm going to begin by offering a sort of a schematic overview of which stories do show up in the Mizmorei Tehillim, which biblical events find their way into the Psalms. So first of all, one that we certainly are all familiar with is creation, right? The creation story shows up in all sorts of poetic ways, drawn into different Mizmorei Tehillim. I'll just mention a few psukim that maybe many of us are familiar with from Shabbos morning davening. Le'ose orim gedolim ki le'olam chasto et ha'shemesh lememshelet hayom ki le'olam chasto hayareach v'achochavim lememshelet halayla. Right, what are we praising God here for? For making these great luminous bodies, right? For making the sun, for making the moon, for making the stars. Okay, so this is, of course, day four of creation. And throughout that Mizmor, we have allusions to creation. And this is not the only psalm that alludes to creation. And the question, one of the questions that we ask ourselves is, how does it allude to creation? How is it drawing creation into the Mizmor? To what end is it doing so? Right? What is the objective of doing this? And is there any exegesis that is involved in doing this? Is it resolving any questions? Is it raising any new ideas of its own? Okay, so we have creation. Many, many of the Mizmorei Tehillim refer to Yetziat Mitzrayim. That's maybe the event that shows up the most in the Mizmorei Tehillim. And we're going to be spending a little bit of time on that, so I'm going to move on to the next topic. We have many Mizmorei Tehillim which talk about the period of time that Am Yisrael wanders through the desert. Okay, so of course, again, you know, a familiar mizmor for many people. Arba'im shana akut bador ve'omar am toei levav heim ve'heim lo yadu derachai. Right, for 40 years, I was angry at this generation. Right, this is the description of the 40 years in the Midbar. And by the way, it's not the only mizmor tehillim that refers quite explicitly to that period. That is a period that, again, finds many different expressions among the Mizmorei Tehillim. We have several Mizmorei Tehillim that refer to the conquest of the land. Okay, again, I found another familiar one. V'natan artzam nachala, nachala liYisrael amo. Right, he gave this inheritance to them. He gave this land to them as an inheritance. Again, that is an event which is going to be woven into many different Mizmorei Tehillim. Now, even the period of the Shoftim, which isn't a particularly, I would say, inspiring period, finds its way into the Mizmorei Tehillim. In fact, we have an explicit reference to Sisra, right? In, I believe it's Pei Gimel, right? Mizmor 83. Yavin Melech Canaan shows up, Yavin Melech Hatzor. Zevach and Tzalmuna, the two kings of Midian that Gideon fights, right? Gideon goes to war with Zevach and Tzalmuna. They actually are mentioned explicitly in that same psalm, Psalm 83. Okay? So again, why? For what purpose? What is the goal of weaving in another biblical story? What does it do for our understanding of the biblical story, and what does it do for our understanding of the psalm, of the goal of the psalm? a couple others, which some of which I think are perhaps more familiar. Certainly, we have many or several Mizmori Tehillim, as I mentioned in the last class, that describe the Chorban, the catastrophe of the destruction of Yerushalayim and the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, of the Temple, and of course the famous one, B'shuv Hashem et Zion, Hayinu Kecholmim. So we go all the way to the period of the return to Zion, the return to Yerushalayim. And of course, one of the things that we're going to see is that there's a tremendous amount of creative license that is taken by the authors, by the composers of these Mizmori Tehillim in weaving in the biblical stories. So that's pretty much the topic that I want to be addressing today. I want to be talking about these different exegetical Mizmorim, how and why they are weaving in the Mizmori Tehillim, the earlier biblical stories, into these Mizmori Tehillim. What I want to do in this class is I basically want to take three different types of weaving in stories. I want to begin with the most obvious and end with what I think is the least obvious. So I want to begin with the way in which some of the Mizmori Tehillim read the Yetziat Mitzrayim story, and particularly since we have a lot of Mizmori Tehillim which read the Yetziat Mitzrayim story and we're somewhat limited in our time, I particularly want to look at the two psalms that describe the series of plagues, right? The Makot. We only have two psalms that actually go through the Makot and list them and describe them. So that's, I think, a good way to try to get a little bit of a sense of how the Mizmori Tehillim are retelling earlier stories, especially because this is such a familiar one. I think it's a good it's a good way to look at the topic. Then I want to show you in our second part of tonight's class. I want to show you how one Mizmor weaves an earlier biblical episode very in a very strong allusion to that earlier biblical episode linguistically. In other words, how it takes the language from an earlier biblical episode and it simply borrows it and puts it into the Mizmor so that it's basically a retelling of an earlier story, and then it goes off in a very surprising direction. But you can't help but know what story it's talking about, because if anyone is even slightly familiar with that earlier story, you can't miss it. In the third part of tonight's class, I want to look at a Mizmor that I think tells an elliptical story, an unclear story. It's clearly anecdotal in nature. It clearly knows what it's talking about, right? We have several Mizmori Tehillim which clearly refer to historical events, but the actual identity of these historical events is unclear, right? And I want to try to maybe offer a little bit of a speculation as to what I think that historical event that is alluded to, what it actually is, maybe why the Mizmor remains elliptical, right? And what it is that we can learn from that Mizmor. So these are the three different topics that I want to address tonight. Let's begin with Yetziat Mitzrayim. Okay, now we know, of course, that Yetziat Mitzrayim, the story of the Exodus from Egypt. Can you hear me? Can everybody hear me? Yeah? Okay. The story of the Exodus from Egypt is the seminal Tanakh story, right? It's the story that shows up over and over and over in the Tanakh. Many of you have heard me say this in various contexts. The story of Yetziat Mitzrayim comes up over 160 times after it ends, okay? Oh, I'm talking about explicit references to it. There are many Mizmori Tehillim that refer to Yetziat Mitzrayim, but the only two Mizmori Tehillim which actually refer to the Makot story, the plague narrative, are Ayin Chet, that is Mizmor 78, and Kuf Hei, Mizmor 105. Now, the first thing I think that we'll note, even without really delving deeply into the Mizmor, you read through this Mizmor, it's not all about the Makot, right? First of all, Ayin Chet, 78, is the second longest Mizmor that we have, right? It's a very long historical retelling of the events that happened to Am Yisrael throughout a very broad period of history, but they do focus for a certain amount of time on the plagues themselves. And the first thing I think that you notice is that it is a very creative retelling. There's a tremendous amount of poetic license that the Mizmor has to retell the plague narrative. And just to give you a little bit of a sense of what I mean by that and to what extent this is true, if you look at Mizmor Ayin Chet, if you look at Psalm 78, you are only going to find seven plagues. Okay? So you all know that there are 10 plagues. I mean, that's, you know, sort of clear. Yeah. Okay, good. And the second thing, of course, is that the order is different. So you can't miss it, right? You have dam, and then you have arov, and then you have tsfardea, right? So you have blood, and then you have these mixed multitudes, and then you go back to frogs, right? And barad and arbeh, right? Locusts and hail. It's out of order, right? So, I mean, and the same thing happens in Psalm 105. So that if you look at Mizmor Kufhei, what you're going to see is not 10 plagues, but 8 plagues. Okay? 8 is good, but it's not 10, right? And again, you're going to see that the order is different. So that the plagues open, not with dam, not with what we're accustomed to, but with choshech, with darkness, which is really the end of the plague narrative as we're accustomed to seeing it. So that's one of the things that I want to note, and that is that there is a certain amount of creative license. We assume that it's part of the larger goal of the mizmor. What is the goal of the mizmor? Well, we'll come back to that point in a few minutes. I want to just begin with some interesting features of exegesis that we find in this mizmor. First and foremost, what I want to suggest is, I think what probably everybody here who's ever encountered any sort of exegesis, right, especially medieval exegesis, you're going to assume that when you're engaged in an exegetical endeavor, you are trying to resolve textual problems, right? You're trying to resolve a problem. And I would assume that an inner biblical exegesis, the same thing is happening, right? The composers of these Mizmorei Tehillim are reading earlier narratives, and they are contending with, how do I retell this story, right? Especially, how do I retell the story if there are certain inherent problems in the story, right? How am I going to address those problems? You can't always fudge it, right, when you're retelling it. So before we actually get to the point where we ask, why are they retelling the whole story, we have to maybe just look at the way that they retell it. So let's open to Mizmor Ayin Chet. Okay, here we have Psalm 78. It's here on your first page, okay? And we'll start really with the question of the plague of blood, okay? So what really is the main problem or the main question that arises when we read about the plague of blood in Sefer Shemot? So the first thing that I think that is very clear is that it's a complex plague, right? There are a lot of reasons that seem to be given for this plague, or a lot of ostensible reasons that this particular plague is the first dramatic plague that is brought on Egypt. The first point that I would mention is the word Ye'or, right? That Nile, which comes up 7 times in the description of the plague of blood in Shemot, right? The Nile River is the symbol of Egypt. Striking the Nile strikes at the very heart of Egypt, her prosperity, her success, her extraordinary success, okay? So we have the Nile, and we have the blood, right? Also very symbolic, okay? For lots of reasons, not the least of which is that, of course, when the Egyptians threw the Jewish babies into the Nile turned to blood. Okay, there's something almost as that seems to be a consequence of their own behavior. At the same time, one could make an argument that this plague is not about either of those things, that this plague is just threatening them existentially. They have no more water to drink, right? One could make another argument that it's about the fish, right? And don't forget, the fish are also a symbol of Egypt, right? It's their livelihood. And it's what the Jews say. It's what Am Yisrael says when they come out of Egypt and they're wandering in the desert in the 11th chapter of Sefer Bamidbar. What are they longing for? Zacharnu et hadaga, right? We remember that fish. Well, we know the fish die, right, during the plague. So there's something a little bit ironic about that memory. Well, let's look at the way in which Psalm 78 presents the plague of blood. Okay, look here in Pasuk Mem Dalet. Okay, it's about halfway down that second paragraph. And look at what it says. Vayafoch ledam ye'orehem v'nozlehem bal yishtayun. Okay, so they turn their Nile to blood, and all of their liquids they could not drink. Okay, so this is an interesting reading. If you look, for example, on page 4, okay, which is where I brought for you here, the section from Shemot, which describes the plague of blood, Shemot 7, right? The source is actually on page 3, but the actual, I mean, the reference is on page 3. You see it at the top of page 4? Okay, I highlighted some of these parts for you. Look at the third, look at Pasuk Yud Tet, which is the end of the second line. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, emor el Aharon, kach matcha, unite yadcha al meimei Mitzrayim. Take your hand and stretch, or take your stick and stretch it out over the waters of Egypt. Now look at all the waters that we're talking about here. Al Naharotam, the rivers, Al Yeorehem, their Nile, the Al Agmehem, I don't know, their lakes, the Al Kol Mikveh Mehem, and on every body of water, the Yudam, the Hayadam Bechol Eretz Mitzrayim. Okay, so this pasuk seems to imply that all the waters of Egypt turn to blood. But there's a little bit of a contradiction. Look ahead at look down at Pasuk Kafbet. You see where I am? Three lines from the bottom, right in the middle. Right? So the Chartumim, the magicians, they also did try to turn the water to blood. Vayifen Paro, and Paro turned around. Vayavo el beito, velo shat libo gam lazot. He turned around and went into his house and he didn't pay attention, implying that there's water in his house. Vayachperu kol Mitzrayim svivota yeor mayim lishtot. And what did the rest of Egypt do? They dug around the Nile to find water to drink. Ki lo yachlu lishtot mi meimei Hayeor, because they couldn't drink from the Nile. There's an inherent contradiction here, right? Could they only not drink from the Nile, or had all the waters in Egypt turned to blood? Well, the answer of this Mizmor Tehillim is everything had turned to blood, right? Nozlehem Bal Yishtayun. This Mizmor makes the assumption that the problem with the plague, or the danger of the plague, was practical, right? Less symbolic and more practical. The problem is that there's nothing to drink, okay? This is an exegetical approach, right? They're interpreting both what the plague is about and resolving the contradiction between the pasuk that seems to suggest that all water turned to blood and the pasuk that seems to suggest that only the Nile water turned to blood. Okay, now, along with this, I think many of us encountered some of the midrashim that are built on that verse in Psalm 78. Right? I remember a midrash that I learned as a young child, that if you were drinking a cup of water, right, and you were Egyptian, it would turn to blood, right? Of course, if you were drinking a cup of water and sharing it with your Jewish friend, right, half of it would turn to blood and the other half would stay water, right? Do you remember that one? Okay, this is all based on this Mizmor Tehillim, V'nozlehem Bal Yishtayun, right? They could not drink any liquids. It is a life-threatening plague. It is about taking away their means to survive. That's the way the Mizmor looks at it here. Kufay looks at it a little bit differently. Look back on page 3. Look in at the top here, in Pasuk Kaftet, right? It's the fourth line from the top. He says rather simply, Hafach et meimehem ledam, he turned their water to blood, vayamot et digatam, and he killed their fish. Okay? So the Mizmor Kufay is a little bit more interested in the fish. It's a little bit of a machloket, right? We have here a difference in the way that blood is being presented. So I'm just using this as an example of when we read the Mizmor, we're trying to understand what is it that they're addressing. They're addressing the question of what is the plague of blood? What is it really about? And also, perhaps one of the questions or the contradictions that arises within the description of the plague itself. Let's look at another example. Look back at page 1. Go back to Psalm 78. And let's look at how they represent our next plague, which is the plague of frogs. Of course, it's not the next plague in Ayin Chet, right? But it is our next plague. Look in Pasuk Mem He. Look at what they say here. By the way, they skip lice altogether, right? So you're not going to find kinim here, okay? Which is maybe a good thing. Okay, pasuk mem hey. All right, yishalach bahem arov. He sends them arov, vayochleim, and they consume them, utzfardea, vatashchitem. Okay, and they send against them frogs, and they destroy them. Okay, now what exactly is the Mizmor addressing here, or what does the Mizmor do with these two plagues? First of all, it switches their order. Okay, that's rather obvious. The second thing I think that we have to note is that the Mizmor links them, right? Tzfardea goes with Arov. It does this also by using the word vatashchitem, right? Tzfardea, the plague of frogs, actually the word lahashchit, to destroy, never appears in the plague of frogs, but it does appear in the plague of Arov. Okay, so by weaving these together, these two plagues, the Mizmor, the Psalm, is able to borrow a term from Arov and put it into frogs. But there's something else that I think has to be noted here, and I think I brought for you a couple of psukim that will help us with that. Look in source number 6. By weaving these two plagues together, the Mizmor is also suggesting that these two plagues are meant to go together. And in fact, of course, they're right. These two plagues are meant to go together. How do I know? Because the description in the Tanakh is a very similar description. Look in source number 6, Shmot Perek Zayin, okay? Ve'im ma'ein ata l'shaleach. Right? What does Moshe tell Paro? If you refuse to send them, I will plague your entire border with frogs. And the Nile will swarm with these frogs. Right? What is this plague? That the frogs are going to be everywhere. They're going to come into your houses, and they're going to come into your house, and they're going to come onto your servants, and they're going to come onto your people. What is the plague of Arov? Look at our next source. Ki im incha mishaleach et ami, says Moshe to Paro, if you do not send out my people, hineni mashliach becha uveavadecha, uveamecha, uvevatecha et ha'arov, umalu batei mitzrayim et ha'arov. They're going to come into your houses. They're going to come onto your people. They're going to come into your servants' quarters. They will be everywhere. When the Mizmor, when the Psalm links these two makot, these two plagues, what the Psalm is really saying is, the Tanakh links these two plagues. We are meant to see these two plagues as being one leads to the next. And in both of these plagues, Paro, for the first time, actually responds positively to the plague and turns to Moshe and says, fine, do what you got to do. Just get rid of this plague for me. He doesn't say it with blood, and he doesn't say it with lice. Okay, this is what he says here with both frogs and Arov. And therefore, I think the psalm here connects these two plagues. But what I think is perhaps more interesting in the plague is what it is trying to answer. What is Mizmor Ein Chet really addressing when he brings this very short pasuk addressing these two plagues? I think it's really pretty simple. These two plagues are quite difficult to understand. It's difficult to understand why they're plagues. Well, let's start with Arov. We have no idea what Arov is, right? Do you know what Arov is? Well, of course you do, because it's lions and tigers and bears, right? That's what the kids know. But what does it mean, Arov? Nobody knows, right? We actually have a tremendous amount of exegesis that has been devoted to try to understand what is Arov? What does it actually mean, the word Arov? So everybody thinks it's, you know, milashon la'arbev, right? It's from the language of mixing things together. And that leads some of the exegetes to say, oh, yes, it's mixed animals or mixed birds, right? There's one very well-known opinion that it's vultures and eagles and all sorts of birds of prey that come down on them. Or the Septuagint suggests mosquitoes, flies,
also mixed multitudes. But it doesn't even have to mean arov. It doesn't have to mean a mixture. It can mean erev. In fact, there's one source that says it was darkness. Heriv alehem ha'orot. Right? God brought darkness into their houses, which is interesting because we have darkness, right? We don't need another one of darkness. That is one opinion, though. Another one says, well, it's ze'evei erev. It's animals of the night. It's wolves, right? Again, as I said, there are all sorts of options here. And one of the problems that I think, we have to address is that we don't actually see the arov doing anything, right? I'm saying in Shemot, what do? Somehow they threaten Paro, but we don't know how they threaten Paro, making it quite difficult for us to identify them. By the way, another opinion is that they're snakes, right? We know Egyptians were terrified of snakes for good reason, right? I'm pretty scared of snakes too. But I mean, you know, the sense is that we read through this whole plague and we emerge saying, what was that? Right? Now, the problem with frogs is a little bit of a different problem. And I'll just say, I think that the Mizmor resolves the problem, at least to some degree, by offering a verb about the arov that doesn't appear in Shemot, which is vayochleim. Right? They ate them. They consumed them. Okay? Now, again, this is an existential threat, right? Doesn't mean that everybody was eaten by whatever this arov is, but the arov consumed them, and I think it's because of this mizmor that most of our mefarshim, that most of the medieval exegetes do actually go in the direction that we're very familiar with today, which is to suggest that these were dangerous animals. Animals that, of course, when hungry, can consume human beings. You wouldn't say that about snakes, right? You wouldn't say that they consume. You wouldn't say it about mosquitoes. They bite you, but they don't necessarily consume you, right? This description in the Mizmor was very influential on later medieval exegesis, but it's an exegetical reading. It is not a direct borrowing from the story itself. The second question that I think that this pasuk, that this verse is addressing, is another problem, which is tzfardea. Okay, so the problem with tzfardea is that we don't really know why they're a plague. I mean, they may be annoying, right? But they can also be cute, right? It's not clear why tzfardea is a plague, right? And why they should be plague number four, especially if we have this sense that the plagues are they're plague number two. But why did you come after Dam, right? I mean, Dam threatens your life, right? Certainly if you can't drink the water, right? It turns the waters to blood. Why then tzfardea after that? Well, lots and lots of exegetes try to answer this question as well. And in fact, famously, Rabbeinu Hananel said, well, you know, how do you know that tzfardea means frog? How do you know? We don't know what tzfardea means, right? So Rabbeinu Hananel says, well, it's not a frog, it's a crocodile. Well, that's scary, right? That's really scary. The Ibn Ezra raises this possibility as well, and Abarbanel rejects this possibility, but it's out there, right? The question as to the identity of the tzfardea. Well, the Mizmor here addresses the question of tzfardea and answers it a little bit in a different way. He says, yeah, the tzfardea, whatever they were, right? They might have been crocodiles, it doesn't say, but they were vatashchitim, right? They destroyed them. What does it mean, vatashchitim? It's a hard word. It's not vayochleim, right? It's not that they consumed them. That would be hard for a frog to do. It's vatashchitim. They destroy them. Now, famously, we have a midrash, which I brought for you in source number 7, which I won't read inside, but I'll just reference here. After I brought for you the Ibn Ezra that talks about the crocodiles, the midrash says, well, what was the danger of these frogs? They castrated them, the frogs. The frogs actually affected and disfigured all of the males in Egypt. And it's an interesting reading, because the Midrash is building on this Mizmor. And why? The answer is very simple. I would say there are two answers, okay? How the Midrash understands the word vatashchitim, which, by the way, it sounds more accurate than vayochleim, okay? It's not they consumed them, it's that they destroyed them. They destroyed their continuity. They destroyed their ability to procreate. Does that sound like something that is certainly an appropriate punishment for Egypt? Okay? Well, first of all, I think that this midrash is based on the usage of the word shachat in Vayikra, okay, when Vayikra talks about some of the mubim, some of the blemishes, right, that you can't have to serve in the Beit HaMikdash, it uses the word shachat ki moshchatam bahem. Their disfigurement is upon them, and they're specifically referencing that sort of disfigurement. But what I think is fascinating about the use of this word, especially if this is what is intended by the Mizmar, is that it creates an incredibly appropriate punishment for the Egyptians, right? What is it that the Egyptians were trying to do? Reduce the population of Am Yisrael. Okay? One of the things that we famously say when we talk about these plagues is that they are midah keneged midah. They are measure for measure. They are punishing the Egyptians for that which the Egyptians tried to do to us. And so this reading of the Mizmor, it's very, very short, and it's very much, you know, contained, but it's an incredibly clever reading, right? It both resolves for us the question of what is the danger of Tzfardea? It links Tzfardea to Arov, and it uses a word that suggests that Tzfardea are some sort of punishment that is appropriate because it pays back the Egyptians measure for measure. Now, we could really go through, you know, many of the different readings in this Mizmor and offer all sorts of different understandings of how the Mizmorim are reading the plague narrative. We don't really have time for that. We're not going to do that at great length. I'll just draw your attention to one more reading that I think is interesting. Go back to Ayin Chet, go back to page one. And let's look at the climax of the plague telling. Look in Pasuk Nun, okay? Basically, after the Mizmor tells five plagues, it pauses, right? The Mizmor pauses. And in Pasuk Mem Tet says as follows, Yishalach bam charon apo. God sent against them his anger, Evra, Vizam, Vitzara, Mishlachat Malachei Ra'im. Right? We know that Pasuk from the Haggadah, right? God sends them his anger. It's a pause. Now, the Mizmor here pauses in the plague narrative to prepare us for the climactic plague, which is, of course, Makat Becharot. But there's something rather odd. Look in Pasuk Nun. Yifaleis nativ la'apo. He spreads out a path for his anger. Lo chasach mimavet nafsham. And he did not stop from killing them. V'chayatam la-dever hiskir. He gave their lives over to the plague of dever, right? Dever being translated plague, right? I mean, it's a sickness, right? V'yach kol b'chor b'mitzrayim. And he killed all of the eldest in Mitzrayim. Reshit onim b'oleicham. Okay, what's problematic here? Well, first of all, dever, right? It's completely out of place, right? Dever was in the fifth plague, right? And now suddenly it's the penultimate plague. It's the one right before Makat Becharot. At the same time, of course, the real problem is clear. I mean, he links it to Makat Becharot. The real problem is clear. Dever didn't kill people, right? That's just not true. Okay, so the Radak struggles with this question. And he says, you know, the word chayatam could mean one of two things. It could be he gave their lives over to Dever, or he gave their animals to Dever. Right? It could be that this is really a description of the death of the animals. But that's a little bit hard also, right? Why is that hard? Because we're describing here the death of people, right? That's very clearly the context. The ultimate climax of the plague is not when the animals drop dead in the fields, right? It's the human beings that are being killed. But by linking these two plagues, what the Mizmor is suggesting is that God's power over life and death is first unleashed in Dever. Okay? Now, Dever, as we know, most commonly appears in Tanakh, not as a plague against animals, but as a plague against human beings. Right? Dever's all over Tanakh. And of course, as we know, the plague against animals easily mutates and becomes a plague against humans. I think this Mizmor is reading something very, very important into the plague narrative. What the Mizmor is suggesting here, in my opinion, is that Dever is there in order to threaten Paro and the Egyptians with the impending plague of Makat Bechorot. There are only two plagues that God brings himself, Dever and Makat Bechorot, right? And not only that, and here I think is really what the Mizmor is really reading. When Moshe goes into Paro to warn him about the plague of hail, what does he say to Paro? He says, Paro, you know, I could have killed you with the Dever, and then you would have been extinguished from the land, but I didn't. I kept you alive, right? In other words, it's very, very clear from the psukim themselves that Dever is there as a warning to Paro that God controls life and death, and that if he doesn't do tshuva, if he doesn't repent from his evil ways, then Makat Bechorot will happen. Then the ultimate Makat will happen. I think it's an excellent reading, right? Because this Mizmor is drawing our attention to the link between Dever and Makat Bechorot, between the two plagues where God brings death, and that link is indicated also in the story in Shmot. Okay, we could go on and on, but I won't. I want to turn our attention to some other things. I just really want to close with perhaps the more interesting question than the specific exegetical points that I've been pointing out, and that is, why does the Mizmor retell the story of the Makot, of the plagues, of Yitziat Mitzrayim? Why do any Mizmorim bring in earlier biblical stories? So the answer is clear from the Mizmor itself, and that is that there's a wide variety of reasons why one might do that, and the Mizmor tells you. So one Mizmor might say, I'm going to tell you the story of Am Yisrael so you will teach your children, okay? Because if not, they are likely to forget God's compassion. They're likely to forget what God did for his people. Another Mizmor might say, I'm now going to raise the story of God saving us for Egypt so as to praise God. Ki le'olam chasdo. Another Mizmor might say, I am telling the story to disseminate God's greatness to the world at large. And another Mizmor, and these are, I brought examples for all of these. I'm just not going to be able to see them inside. But here on the source sheet, I brought those introductions. Each of these points are specifically made in the introduction to the Mizmor. Another Mizmor might have a more pragmatic approach where they turn to God and they say, God, I am reminding you of your compassions and of the fact that once you saved me, now save me again, right? So there's all sorts of different reasons why a Mizmor might retell an earlier event. But each of these reasons, I think each of the Mizmorim, need to be seen within the context of these reasons, and that's certainly something that is our obligation to do when we encounter these Mizmorim, these different psalms, which have retellings of earlier events. Maybe we'll just pause and look just at the introduction to Psalm 78, because that's the psalm I think that we've spent the most time on, and get a little bit of a sense of what it is that they say here. Okay. Let's look in Pasuk Bet. Eftecha v'mashal pi. Abia chidot mini kedem. I'm going to open my mouth with a mashal, with some sort of parable. And I'm going to say riddles from earlier times. Asher shamanu v'neda'em. We heard about this and we know this. V'avotenu sipru lanu. And our fathers told us this. Lo nichached mibnehem. And we will not keep this from their sons. L'dor acharon misaprim tehilot Hashem. To the very end, to the very last generation, we will retell the praises of God, ve'ezuzo, and his strengths, v'nifleotav asher asa, and all of the wonders that he did. Vayakem edut b'Yaakov Torah sam b'Yisrael asher tziva et avotenu lehodiam livnehem. God commanded our fathers to tell their sons leman yedu dor acharon, so that the final generation will know. Banim yivaledu yakumu v'yisapru livnehem. This is the Seder, right? We have an obligation to tell and retell from generation to generation. Why? V'yasimu v'lohim kislam, so that they will put their strength in God. V'lo yishkechu ma'alalei el, and they will not forget the deeds of God. U'mitzvotav yintzoru, and they will keep his commandments. Okay? And that is the purpose of Ayin Chet. It tells us very explicitly. There are many different reasons to retell history. But if you're looking to remind people of God's strength and his greatness, you might tell the story of the plagues in the order in which it is told in Ayin Chet, which seems to be deliberately arranged in order to show the growing severity of God's punishments to Egypt, and the way in which God brings the story to a climactic conclusion, thereby showing both God's caring for his people and at the same time God's great power. That seems to be the design of the Mizmor Tehillim. Okay, but I want to now turn our attention to our next topic. This is sort of just to whet our appetite a little bit. We certainly don't have the time to properly delve into every detail in these Mizmor Tehillim. I want to turn our attention to Mizmor 89, right? Pei Tet, which I brought for you here in source number 9. Okay, if you turn the page and you look at pages 5 and 6, what you're going to find is a chart. Okay, you see it at the bottom of page 5 and all of page 6. And I believe this chart probably continues. Yes, it does. On to page 7. Again, we're not going to read the whole chart. It's really just for you to get an impression of how Shmuel Bet Perek Zion, the 7th chapter in the 2nd book of Samuel, is echoed in Psalm 89. Right? You really just can't miss it. When you read through Psalm 89, what you feel are the linguistic echoes of a very important chapter in David's life. So in order to understand it, let's look at the source right before the chart, 2 Samuel 7, and we'll see why this is such an important chapter in David's life. Okay, we're now reading from the book of Samuel. It is it's not a very interesting chapter as chapters go in the book of Shmuel, right? The book of Shmuel is filled with intrigue and drama. And this is a parak where God comes to David and gives him a promise. It's the parak where David tries to build the temple, right? And remember, Nathan the prophet first says yes, and then he says, nope, just kidding, you can't build the temple, right? But as sort of a compensation, right, God gives David a promise. Okay, let's look at that promise here in 2 Samuel 7. Hu yivne bayit lishmi. He, your son, Shlomo, he will build the Beit HaMikdash for my name. V'chonanti et kisei mamlachto ad olam. I will establish the throne of his kingship forever. Ani eyeh lo la'av v'hu yeyeh li leven. I will be for him as a father, and he will be for him, for me as a son. God is describing the relationship that he is going to have with the Davidic dynasty. Asher ba'avoto v'ochachtiv b'shevet anashim. When he sins, I will chastise him with the rod of people, uvenigev ne'adam, and with the afflictions of people. V'chasti lo yasur imenu. But I won't take away my faithfulness to him, my kindnesses to him, kasheri siroti meim Shaul, asheri siroti melefanecha. I'm not going to do to him what I did to Shaul. Shaul gets one generation of kingship. David is different. Your son's going to be on the throne. He's going to build the temple, and he will remain on the throne for eternity. Look at the next pasuk. V'ne'eman beitcha u'mamlachtecha ad olam. Your house, your kingship will remain forever, lefanecha. Kis'acha yenachon ad olam. Right? In this little passage that we read, what was the phrase that stood out over and over? Ad olam. Ad olam. Chesed. Ne'emanut. Right? Kindness. Faithfulness, more accurately. Right? God gives a promise of an eternal Davidic dynasty. It's a very important parak. David is, of course, very grateful, and he forgives God for not letting him build the Beit HaMikdash. So this is, you know, certainly good compensation. If you look at the Mizmor, go go back to the beginning of the Mizmor, Psalm number 9, right on bottom of page 4. Let's look at what this Mizmor is about. It's a wonderful Mizmor, at least in the beginning. Okay, let's look at what the Mizmor says, right? Maskile Itana Ezrachi, you see where I am? Yep. Chasteh Hashem Olam Ashira. I'm going to always sing of God's kindnesses. L'dor v'dor odia emunatcha b'fi. Do you see those two words? Chesed and emunah. You see it? Those words appear over and over and over in the Mizmor. Okay? Chesed and emunah. I'm going to sing of God's faithfulness, of God's intention to keep giving me these kindnesses. Ki amarti olam chesed yibaneh shamayim tachin emunatcha b'em. You see it again? Chesed and emunah. Karati vrit levichiri. I made a covenant with my selected one. Nishpati leDavid avdi. I took an oath to David, my servant. Ad olam. You see those words? Achin zarecha. I will establish his descendants forever. Vaniti leDor vador kis acha sela. From generation to generation will be your throne. Okay. Now look at our next page. We'll skip ahead to Perek of Av. I mean, he continues on in this fashion. The Mizmor continues on saying, thank you, God. This is wonderful. You've given us this great promise. Look in Pasuk of Aleph. Matzati David Avdi. I have found David, my servant. B'shemen kodshi meshachtiv. I anointed him with my holy oil. Asher yadi tikon imo. My hand will always establish him. Zroi tamtzenu. Right? See where I am? Yeah, okay. Skip ahead to Pasuk Kafhei, right? Three Pasukim down. Ve'emunati v'chasti imo. Right? Again, there's that emunan chesed. Uvishmi tarum karno. V'samti v'yam yado v'narot yimino. I will make him rule over the sea. I will enable him to be strong. Look at the next Pasuk. Hu yikra'eni avi ata. Right? He will call me, you are my father. Elivitzur Yeshuati. Af ani bechor etnehu. I'll make him my eldest son. Does it remind you of what we read? We just read several psukim in Shmuel Bet Perek Zion. It was just really meant to give you a sense of how those psukim are being woven into this really wonderful mizmor. This is a mizmor about God's chesed, about God's emunah, about God's promise of eternal fidelity to the Davidic dynasty, his truthful promises. All nice and good, right? This takes us until verse 38. Okay, look at verse 38. Ki yareach yikon olam va'ed bashachak ne'man sela. Right? Ki yareach yikon olam va'ed bashachak ne'man sela. Right? It's going to be established forever like the moon. Okay, now look at the next pasuk. Ve'ata zanachta v'tim'as. But you, God, you spurned and you rejected. Hit'abarta im mishichecha. You became very angry with your anointed one. Ne'arta brit avdecha. You spurned the covenant with your servant. Chilalta la'aretz nizro. You profaned his crown by throwing it on the ground. Paratzta kol gederotav. You broke through all of his fences. Samta mivtzarav mechita. Right? Skip ahead a little bit. Pasuk, look down in Pasuk Nun. Okay, let's go to the end. Pasuk Nun. Ayei chasadecha harishonim, Adonai. Nishpata leDavid beemunatecha. Where is the chesed? Where is the emunah? This is quite a mizmor. This is, I think, one of the most powerful mizmorim that I know of. It is so powerful, and it is so accusatory that at the introduction to this mizmor, the Ibn Ezra famously quotes a chacham from Sfarad, a chacham gadol. Right? Some of you have heard me say this before. A wise man from Sfarad, who refused to say this mizmor because it was so outrageous in its presumptuous accusation against God. That's the power of this mizmor. By the way, we have it on good authority that, who is that Chacham Echad? Anybody know? Rabbi Yehuda Levi, probably. Right? When the Ibn Ezra quotes a Chacham Echad, he's usually quoting Rabbi Yehuda Levi. We don't know if it's him. The Ibn Ezra leaves him unnamed, so we should probably leave him unnamed. But the idea of this mizmor is really, I think, very stunning. What the mizmor does is it brings in this sort of idyllic kind of mizmor for the first 38 psukim, and then suddenly the mizmor crashes to a halt. Disaster strikes. All bets are off, right? All promises have been canceled, rendered null and void. Did that happen? Right? This is a response to the Chorban. This is a response not just to the end of the Davidic dynasty, but to all of the disasters of 586 BCE, everything that we believed, the Beit HaMikdash, Yerushalayim, God's presence in Yerushalayim, God's promise of eternal kingship to the Davidic dynasty, all of this has been overturned in an instant. And what this mizmor does is, by weaving into the first part of the mizmor, God's promise to David, he brings it there in order to give us all the experience of the suddenness and the magnitude of the crash into reality that takes place after the destruction of Yerushalayim. Where is God's faithfulness? Where is Shmuel Bet Perek Zion? What has happened? And I think that this is a striking and powerful example of how Mizmorei Tehillim might use earlier biblical passages for their real intention, for their real goal, which here is not to retell the story, right? It's not like what we saw in Ayin Chet in Psalm 78, where he's retelling a story so that everybody should know the story because it's a beautiful story, it's an important story, and it's a foundational story, right? That's why Psalm 78 retells the story of the Exodus. That is not why Psalm 89 retells the story of David. It's very surprising. When we're reading through the mizmor, it feels good and beautiful until you get to verse 39. And then you see why he is retelling the story of God's promise to David. Okay, that's the second example that I wanted to bring to your attention. And now I want to turn our attention to a third example. Again, it's a familiar mizmor, I think, or I don't know if again, but this mizmor, I think, is probably more familiar to many of you. If you look here at the last page, this is Psalm 48. It's familiar because it's Shir Shel Yom of Monday, right? It's Shir Shel Yom of Yom Sheni. And It's a mizmor that opens with a praise of Yerushalayim, right? Which is certainly what we are doing right now, right? This is the period, right? We're approaching Yom Yerushalayim, and this mizmor is the subject seems to be Yerushalayim. We have many mizmori tehillim, which the subject is Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim's beauty, Yerushalayim's presence, the presence of God in Yerushalayim, what Yerushalayim contributes to the world. That's how the mizmor starts. So let's look at the beginning of this mizmor. Gadol Hashem umhulal me'od. God is great and very praised. Be'ir Eloheinu Har Kodesho. In the city of our God, the mountain of holiness. You see where I am? Yeah? Okay, I'm on page 7 on the last page, right? That final mizmor. Look in Pasuk Gimel. Yefeinof. It is beautiful of elevation. Misos Kol Haaretz. It is a joy to all the world. Har Tzion, it is the mountain of Zion, Yarkete Tzafon, Kiryat Melech Rav. It is the city of the great king. So we focus here on the city's beauty. We focus on the fact that the city is a source of joy. And we focus upon the fact that God belongs to the city, or the city is the expression of God. It's God's greatness that we find in the city. God is present in the city. He's also present in the palaces. Look in Pasuk Dalet. Elohim be'arminoteha. God in her palaces, noda lemiskav. He became known as a safe haven. Okay, so here already we're beginning to ask ourselves why, right? I mean, what does that mean? Noda lemiskav. God became known in Yerushalayim as a haven for people who are looking to escape their enemies, right? Miskav. It sort of sounds like a place of security. But what happens in the next psukim actually even more piques our curiosity, because if the beginning of the mizmor sort of starts out very general, right? Yerushalayim is wonderful. Yerushalayim is beautiful. God is in Yerushalayim. It's a great place to be, right? We all know this, right? The mizmor starts out as a tribute to Yerushalayim, but suddenly it diverges in an anecdotal direction, okay? That's what happens in the mizmor. We have no idea what this anecdote is about. But look in the next pasuk. Ki hinei ha-melachim no'adu. Because the kings got together. Avru yachdav. They passed together through Yerushalayim. Hei marau. They saw it. Ken tamahu. They were amazed. Nivhalu. Nechpazu. They became panicked and afraid. Ra'ada achazatam sham. A trembling seized them there. Chil kayoleda, right? A fear or a trembling of the body, like a woman in the throes of labor, right? That's a sort of an odd description. Beruach kadim, like an easterly wind, tishaber oniot Tarshish, that breaks the ships of Tarshish. Again, it's describing their bodily movements. They're being blown back and forth by these great winds, and they are broken by them, okay? What is going on? Ka'asher shamanu. This is a quote. Just as we heard, ken ra'inu, so we have seen, bi'ir Hashem tzva'ot, in the city of God, bi'ir Eloheinu, in the city of our God, Elohim yechoneneha, ad olam, selah. God will establish this city forever. So this is an anecdote, right? So I'm reading this and I'm saying, when, why, where, what is it? What is the story about? Does this draw on a previous biblical event? If so, which one? Why? To what end? What is the point of telling a story that is not clarified for us, right? What is this story about? Well, first of all, I think we have to see that we have these regal passersby, right? We have these kings that pass through Yerushalayim. Their response is amazement, terror, panic, and finally, conversion, right? Ir Eloheinu, they say, right? This is the city of our God. These aren't our kings, right? These are outsiders. But before they get to that point, their fear causes them to lose confidence, to lose their poise, their royal dignity, right? Think about the fact that these kings are shaking uncontrollably. And what is the metaphor that is used? Like a woman in labor, a symbol of human weakness that seems directly opposed to regal power, right? Regal male power, right? That's who we're talking about here, right? And of course, the wind that is blowing and breaking the ships of Tarshish also seems to imply the loss of regal resources and control. Don't forget that the kings send their ships to Tarshish to bring back precious stones, to bring back gold, to bring back valuable resources. Who breaks these ships, right? God breaks these ships. Their response to Yerushalayim is a response of basically throwing up their hands and saying, we control nothing, right? We are controlled by an external power. There's a sense here that they lose their own sense of their own royal standing. All of this, of course, leads us to that climactic verse where they recognize God. Ultimately, what's very clear in this verse is that whoever these kings are, the end of the story of encountering Yerushalayim is a moment in which they proclaim their newfound belief of God in the city of Yerushalayim. Just as we heard, so we have seen in the city of God, in the city of our God. And of course, what they ultimately determine is that this city shall be established by God for eternity. Okay? I guess never say eternity. That's the same ad olam here, right? And that's their conclusion. Now, the precise background to this story remains elusive. The Mizmor never actually tells us what is the background here. And the Mifarshim, the different exegetes, battle this out. There's no doubt that there's something anecdotal going on. Somebody knew what they were talking about, right? Are they describing some sort of event that has not yet happened, that is going to happen in the end of days? It's an eschatological Mizmor. more. Some of the different exegetes do go in that direction. I'm going to suggest something else. I'm going to suggest a possible historical background to this psalm that is loosely based on an Ibn Ezra. Okay, I say loosely based because the Ibn Ezra doesn't say it on this psalm. He says it two psalms ago. He says it on Psalm 46, but on a pasuk, on a verse, which is very, very similar to our Mizmor. And therefore, I say I'm loosely basing this on the Ibn Ezra. What I want to suggest is that this Mizmor is describing the aftermath of the failed siege of Sanherib against Jerusalem, right? Sanherib, the great Assyrian king who swept voraciously and cruelly throughout the ancient Near East, conquering every city in his path, okay? And, of course, he is the continuation of the Assyrian kings who exiled the 10 tribes, right? It comes about 15 years after the exile, or 17 years after the exile of the 10 tribes. And eventually, Sanherib, who's an extremely successful king, makes his way to Eretz Yehuda, right? He makes his way to Yehuda. And is he successful in Yehuda? Does he conquer the land of Yehuda? The answer is yes. He conquers the land of Yehuda. He himself says that he conquers 46 cities, all of which were well-fortified cities. And we know that he did conquer the whole area of the Shvela. He conquered a lot of the Negev. One of the reasons that we find the broad wall in the old city is because Chizkiyahu, who is the king of Yehuda, had to expand the city because everybody was running to Yerushalayim to get away from the threat of Sanherib. Sanherib was extremely successful everywhere he turned. And then he gets to Yerushalayim, okay? This is in 701 BCE. This episode of Sanherib besieging Yerushalayim is such a significant episode that it is told three times in the Tanakh. It's told, the whole story is told once in Malachim Bet, a second time in Yeshayahu, and a third time in Divrei Hayamim Bet. It is also alluded to all over the Nevi'im. This is an extremely significant episode because, of course, what happens? Sanherib besieges Yerushalayim with great fanfare and with great arrogance. And he stands and he says to the people, remember, or his general, the Rav Shakeh, says to the people, he says, do you really think that Chizkiyahu can save you from me? I have conquered every single city that I have ever encountered. What makes you think that you can be saved? Did the gods of the other cities save them? Did the God of Shomron save the tribes of Israel from the power of Ashur? Right? Of course, the same God, right? So this is a particularly striking moment. And of course, Sanherib's boastful claims do not fall on deaf ears. The people are very afraid. Chizkiyahu says to the Rav Shakeh, please don't speak Judean. Right? Speak in Aramaic. We don't want the people to hear. And of course, what does the Rav Shakeh say? The point is, I want the people to hear. I want them to know we are going to conquer you. Surrender. And of course, Chizkiyahu sends a message to Yeshayahu the Navi, because Chizkiyahu is a very righteous king. And he sends a message to Yeshayahu and he says, what should I do? And Yeshayahu says, nothing. Trust in God. Not even one arrow will penetrate Yerushalayim. Nothing is going to enter Yerushalayim. The Assyrian army is going to go home or fail and go home with their tail between their legs. And of course, that night, a malach hamavet, right? An angel of death. We might call it the bubonic plague if we like, right? An angel of death strikes the Assyrian camp, killing 185,000 troops, and they wake up in the morning, and everyone's dead. The most striking feature of this episode is its stunning failure, right? Sanhariv, in his annals, right, when he retells his successes, right? So he basically says, well, then I came to this place and I conquered them, and then I killed the king and I took the prisoners, and then I got great tribute, and then I went on to my next place. And he tells this story over and over and over until he gets to Yehuda, and he says, oh, and in Yehuda, I conquered 46 cities, right? And then I went to Yerushalayim. You know what I did in Yerushalayim? I locked them up like a bird in a cage. Right? You hear it? What he didn't say speaks volumes, right? Sanhariv never says, I conquered Yerushalayim. I killed the king. I took the people out of Yerushalayim, because he didn't, right? He did not conquer Yerushalayim. And it is a stunning failure. And I think that the miraculous salvation of Yerushalayim, which is certainly grounds for this amazement and this this reaction, might really be the backdrop for our celebratory psalm. Against all odds, against the military supremacy, the numerical superiority, the advantage of weaponry, the advantage of experience that the Assyrian army had, Yerushalayim did not fall, and Yerushalayim did not even have one arrow penetrate it. Sound familiar? Okay. This is our 50th year that we're celebrating Yom Yerushalayim, the 1967 war, okay? What happens in this psalm? The local kings arrive in Yerushalayim seeking confirmation that the rumors that they heard about Jerusalem's miraculous salvation were in fact true. And indeed, they walk around, and what do they see? Yifei Nof, Misos Kol Haaretz, Har Tzion, Yarkatei Tzafon, Kiryat Melech Rav, the city is unscathed. Its beauty and structural integrity are intact. The royal outsiders respond with astonishment, acknowledging that only God could have delivered the city from this incredible threat. And this, I think, really is certainly possibly the background for this mizmor. But what I think is really amazing about this mizmor is the fact that the anecdotal story doesn't end the mizmor, right? It would have been enough for me if that had been the end. I would have said, wow, people came to Yerushalayim. They recognized God through Yerushalayim. They were stunned. They were amazed. They were confounded. They were in awe. They were panicked. They were frightened. They saw God's power. They saw God's strength. That's enough, right? But the mizmor, of course, doesn't end there. And it suggests that the mizmor is not about God's greatness through this military victory, but rather it's about the responsibility of Am Yisrael in the aftermath of this great miraculous delivery. In the first half of this mizmor, the mizmor tells us of the city's greatness, of the perspective of the foreign kings when they come to Yerushalayim and they see God. It is a universal message of God's greatness that is conveyed passively through the city. I mean, not passively from God's perspective, but passively from the perspective of Jerusalem's residents. But what happens in the next half? Look in Pasuk Yud. Diminu Elohim chasdecha bekerev hechalecha. We contemplated God, your chesed, when we were in the midst, in the depth of your heichal. Kishimcha Elohim, kein tehilatcha. Like your name, God, so is your praise. Al katzvei aretz, it goes to the ends of the earth. Tzedek mal'a yeminecha. Your right hand is filled with righteousness. Yismach har tzion tagelna b'not Yehuda. Har Tzion is happy, and the daughters of Yehuda are filled with joy. Liman mishpatecha, because of your laws. The second part of the mizmor takes the story one step farther. The second half of the mizmor tells us how the residents of Yerushalayim rise to the challenge of how the internal people respond to the event of seeing God's hand, of seeing God's miraculous salvation in Yerushalayim. It is not enough for Yerushalayim to function passively in order to act as a prism through which you can see God's greatness. Yerushalayim's inhabitants must contemplate this message. They must consider the responsibility that it places upon them, and they must recognize that Yerushalayim is a vehicle through which they can proclaim God's morality to the world. His chesed, his tzedek, his mishpat, God's kindness, his righteousness, and his laws. Yerushalayim's residents are meant to assume a responsibility after the miracle, and not just to live in Yerushalayim and to enjoy the benefits of its beauty and of its evident presence of God. I think this is an extraordinary message. I think it's as extraordinary a message today as it was when this mizmor was composed. Perhaps for that reason, this mizmor is deliberately elusive in terms of the actual event that takes place, because we, of course, today are set in a couple of days to commemorate an event of equally extraordinary magnitude that took place in Yerushalayim almost 50 years ago. In 1967, God again displayed his great strength in Yerushalayim, and of course, against all odds, the numerical and military superiority of the enemy, God saved Yerushalayim, bringing about, of course, a reaction from the world of amazement and fear and wonder and awe and admiration for this obvious hand of God that he displayed through the salvation of Yerushalayim and, of course, of Israel in general. But, of course, what we understand when we read this mizmor is that this mizmor cannot, should not, it must not end with the great nisim, with the great miracles of God, with the witnessing of God's evident hand in Yerushalayim. In fact, of course, God's miracles, especially the miracles that he does for us, impose upon us a responsibility, an obligation to use this miracle in order to convey, to disseminate the word of God to the world. Ki mitzion Tetzei Torah, to disseminate God's chesed, his tzedek, his mishpat, to generate worldwide recognition of God's morality. In this way, we who are privileged to live in Yerushalayim today and to experience all of the miracles that have accompanied us throughout the last 69 years and perhaps especially throughout the last 50 years, we can help Yerushalayim to become Masos Kol Haaretz, a joy to all the world and a special joy to those of us who merit to live in God's holy city. Yismach Har Tzion, Tagelna Benot Yehuda, Leman Mishpatecha. Thank you.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
If you are interested in history, archaeology, Jewish philosophy, Israeli literature, Jewish law, out-of-the-box field trips, we have it all this summer at our executive learning seminar. The topic? Returning to Zion. Old faces, new issues. Combine all that with our outstanding faculty, high-level participants, warm and friendly atmosphere, gourmet lunches. That is the winning formula for a transformative experience that you will remember for years to come. Join us this summer. Sign up now. I look forward to seeing you.